I'd like to turn it over now to my colleague Larry Reed to offer a few introductory comments, and then we'll move into Steve Manjin's introduction and the rest of the seminar. Larry?
Thank you, Larry. My job is to introduce Steve Manjin today. Really appreciate Steve being our introductory speaker here in this Risky Learning series. I think we're really proud to have this as a joint effort. The Risky Learning web seminar series has the Superfund Basic Research Program working with the Superfund office and headquarters, including the TIP program, Technology Innovation Program, as well as the Office of Research and Development, whom we've worked with closely, and a EPA regional offices participating at various times as moderators or introductory speakers or actual participants in the various series we've had to date and the future ones we'll have in the future after this Dean Apple series. I'm really proud to be introducing Steve Manjin. I've worked with Steve over the years. He's one of those wise people at a very young age. He spent 25 years with EPA, and the past 15 of those have been in a very key position within the Office of Research and Development in the regional offices, the Superfund Technical Liaison position in the Boston Regional Office, where it plays a critical point of communication, liaison, and technical hands-on fillings between the research world and the program offices in the region and states and private stakeholders. Steve's particular focus is in the waste program areas. That's where I've dealt with Steve over the past many years. Steve deals with Superfund, RCRA, underground storage tanks, other hazardous waste-related areas. He's worked not only in the Boston Regional Office, Region 1, but also the Chicago Regional Office, EPA headquarters, and at state level. He is a geologist by training, so this is a particular forte and interest of his. We really appreciate him participating in some of our conferences in the past. And at that point, let me turn it over to you, Steve.
Hi, Larry. I want to thank you for that very kind introduction and note that it's a pleasure to be here. As many of you may know, the purpose of these Risky Learning seminars is to try and promote the partnership that EPA strives to have with NIEHS and their Superfund Basic Research Program. We are all interested in trying to communicate, you know, the results of the latest research to a wide audience so that we can all begin to, A, be aware of what researchers are doing, but more importantly, be able to use the results of those research activities. We anticipate that the Superfund Basic Research Program will continue to work closely with EPA and EPA's Office of Research and Development, as well as the Superfund program, to collaborate on research planning and putting out the results of that research so, again, it can be used. Let me note that today's talk is particularly relevant given the agency's ongoing interest in in-situ remedies and how we can use them to clean up sites without necessarily being invasive. So a low-energy, lower-cost approach, if you will. Certainly using biological processes is of particular interest since they could be often used, if not as a remedy or a sole remedy at a site, but as a polishing step to a suite of technologies that might be applied at a Superfund site. I think from my perspective, I'm beginning to appreciate that no one technology in one pass of that technology is likely to clean up a site, hence the idea of a treatment train where I think biological processes will play an important role as sort of putting the final polish on a site. That said, I would also encourage participants to stay tuned to the Kulin website about future seminars that Larry has outlined and so that we can get ideas on what the needs are of the audience that's out there. And if NIEHS and SBRP can address it, we'll be happy to do it. And please keep in mind, at the end of these presentations, we'll be doing questions and answers. So as you're hearing the presentation, you might be noting questions that you might want to ask. And with that, I'll turn it over to our first speaker, I believe, Dr. Jim Field, unless Larry wants to say something else.
No, I think we're ready. We can go to Dr. Field.
Okay, hello everybody. I'm Jim Field. I'm speaking from you from Tucson, Arizona, where the weather's really quite nice right now. You should be on slide number one, and I'm just going to mention the slide numbers as I go through. So I'm going to now go to the second slide, and I want to tell you that the way I'm organizing my talk today, it's based on a comprehensive literature review that I did. I spent 3 years reviewing all the literature there was available on the biodegradation of chlorinated solvents. The net result of all that reviewing is in the publication that you see there on the second slide. And if you're having problems getting to that publication, if you want it, you can just send me an email and I'll be happy to email you back a reprint. So now I'm moving on to the third slide. You probably, if you read the abstract for the presentation, you probably noticed that one of the key points is that we have to consider biodegradation reactions as redox reactions. And you'll see a very simple scheme here on the third slide where we see that electron donor combined with an electron acceptor form an oxidized electron donor and a reduced electron acceptor. And in the case of chlorinated solvents, the chlorinated, we have examples where the chlorinated solvents can be either one of these roles, either the electron donor or the electron acceptor. And as we move to slide four, you'll see an example of both of those. On the upper bullet, you'll see an example where vinyl chloride is behaving as an electron donor for microorganisms and is becoming oxidized to CO2 and chloride. In order to get that to happen, though, there needs to be an electron acceptor. In this particular example here, the electron acceptor is oxygen, and it is getting reduced to water. A more common example is the case where the chloridated solvents become reduced. In this role, then they are behaving as an electron donor. What we see here is that PCE is being reduced to ethene. And in order to make that happen, you have to have an electron donor. And in this particular example, the electron donor shown is methanol being oxidized to CO2. Moving to the fifth slide, I'm just going to go over, and these next two slides go over some terminology. What does biodegradation mean exactly? People have different meanings when you use the word biodegradation. For me, it's just any biologically catalyzed transformation resulting in a chemical of simpler form. What most people would like when there's biodegradation is that there's complete mineralization. That means that there's a conversion of the organic contaminant into its mineral products. So as an example shown here, we see vinyl chloride being converted into CO2 and chloride, two inorganic products. Sometimes biodegradation might mean biotransformation. Sometimes this is just when you just have a change in the pollutant, but not necessarily a mineralization. Sometimes a change is desirable. It makes the compound less toxic, or sometimes it doesn't change the toxicity, or it might make it even more toxic. Here you see an example of a non-desirable biotransformation in which TCE is converted to chloral. I'm now on slide six. Sometimes we have words, and when we talk about biodegradation, we have words that refer to the role of the compound in the biodegradation process. If we refer to growth substrate, sometimes also referred to as the primary substrate for primary metabolism, then in this case, then the substrate is used as the main energy and carbon source for the microbial growth. And from a bioremediation standpoint, this is a very good deal because as the pollutant is being degraded, then our microorganisms are growing, and so the biocatalyst is increasing, and so rates can actually increase in time as more and more of the contaminant is degraded. Another type of metabolism is what's referred to as co-metabolism. In this case, then we have basically an accidental reaction of the pollutant with the enzyme or maybe an enzyme cofactor from an organism that's actually busy metabolizing another substrate. So I have an example here, which is the classic example. in which you have microorganisms growing on methane under aerobic conditions, so they're oxidizing methane. For the first enzyme reaction in this degradation pathway of methane, you have one enzyme referred to as methane monooxygenase, and the enzyme can also accidentally react with TCE and promote the biotransformation of TCE. But we have to appreciate that in this particular co-metabolism, the organism isn't benefiting from the fact that the TCE is degrading. It's only benefiting from the fact that the methane is degrading. Now I'm passing the slide on to slide 7. Then a lot of times with chlorinated solvents, we have remediation under anaerobic conditions. That's because we would like to foster the possibility of reductive dehalogenation. This is basically when we lose a halogen group because of the introduction of electrons into the molecule. The most common form of reductive dehalogenation is shown here, where we get a replacement of the halogen with a hydrogen atom. So we see that we have RCl being replaced with a hydrogen atom and leaving behind RH. Now there's a special form of reductive dehalogenation, which is referred to as halorespiration. And this is a case where the organohalogen is actually being used in an energy-yielding reaction as an electron acceptor. In much the same way that we would use oxygen for respiration, these microorganisms use the organohalogen as an electron acceptor for the respiration. And they gain energy by this process, so this too is a good deal because as the halorespiration proceeds, then the microorganisms are growing. So as the pollutant is being degraded, the biocatalyst concentration increases and we're getting faster and faster rates of degradation. Now I'm on slide 8. I'm going to review five common mechanisms of dechlorination by microorganisms. Only one of these mechanisms has an absolute requirement for oxygen, and that's the first one, which I refer to as oxygenolytic. And this is usually involving monooxygenases, where you get the, like in this particular example, vinylchloride is being transformed into an epoxide that then spontaneously falls apart. A second mechanism is hydrolytic, in which water hydrolyzes the halogen group and replaces the halogen group with the OH group. This particular type of degradation hydrolytic is common among the chloroethanes. Then the last three mechanisms, now I'm on slide number 9. The last three mechanisms are all reductive in nature, and the most common of the reductive processes is referred to as reductive hydrogenolysis. And this is when we have a donation of electrons to the molecule and a proton replaces the chlorine. So we have a chlorine group being replaced by a hydrogen group. The second type of reductive mechanism is referred to as hydrolytic reduction. This second mechanism, a reductive mechanism, is very common among the chloromethane group. And what we see here is that during the reduction, we get the formation of a carbene radical. So we have unpaired electrons, and these are very reactive, and so they will react with the most major constituent in the media. So if it's aqueous, then it's going to react then with water, and then the water is going to get hydrolyzed. And then we get the formation of organic acids or carbon monoxide, which later will go on and be further degraded to CO2. And then the last mechanism I'm going to cover is referred to as reductive dichloroelimination. This mechanism is very common among the highly chlorinated ethanes. And what we see here is with the input of electrons that two chlorines come off the compound, and then we get the formation of the double bond. Now I'm moving on to slide number 11. And in the next two slides, I want to point out some important trends. As we consider many different compounds, what are some of the trends that we might be able to expect? an aerobic degradation, a general trend, especially among the hydrocarbons without any oxygen-containing groups. We can expect that as the chlorine number increases, the biodegradation potential under aerobic conditions decreases. I didn't have a really beautiful example under aerobic with chlorinated solvents, but I do have a very beautiful example with polychlorinated biphenols. What you see here in this graph is the extent of degradation of biphenols as a function of the chlorine content in the molecule. So here you have various polychlorinated biphenol mixtures. On the left-hand side of the graph, you have just pure biphenol. It's completely degraded by 100%. And as we move to the right of the graph, we have mixtures that have incrementally more and more chlorine in the PCBs. And we see as the chlorine number increases, the biodegradability drastically decreases. And the particular experiment here was carried out with aerobic activated sludge. Then on slide 12, you can see some important trends under anaerobic conditions. What we see then is that as the chlorine number increases, the rate of biotransformation seems to increase. What you see here is a summary of one of my former PhD students from 1999, where she evaluated the co-metabolism in anaerobic sludge of a series of chlorinated solvents. And this is kind of like the summary of her entire thesis, where you can see then as the chlorine number increases, the rates of anaerobic co-metabolism of all these different chlorinated solvents in any given series generally increases. The best example is with the chloroethanes, that's the black squares. And you have to appreciate that the y-axis here is a logarithmic scale. So you can see that how as we go from a chlorine number of 2 to 6, you can really appreciate how we have orders of magnitude increases in the rates of chloroethane co-metabolism by anaerobic sludge. The same general trend can also be seen with chloroethenes. There is one exception, however. You see a little X that's kind of hiding behind some black squares up there. That happens to be 1,1 dichloroethene. Aside from that one, the rest of the isomers seem to follow the general trend. And then we see that chloromethanes, those are the triangles, they also follow the trend with the exception of chloromethane. The reason that chloromethane is an exception is because it's not being co-metabolized. It's probably actually being metabolized. As we reviewed the literature, we found that we can divide the biodegradation of chlorinated solvents into five major physiological roles that it has for microorganisms. The five roles are shown here on slide 13. The first role is that the chlorinated solvents can serve as a carbon and energy source under aerobic metabolism. The second role that we identified is that it can be co-metabolized, also referred to as co-oxidation under aerobic conditions. The third physiological role is that the chlorinated solvents can be a carbon and energy source under anaerobic conditions. The fourth role that we identified is that the chlorinated solvent can be an electron acceptor under anaerobic conditions. This is has a special name. It's referred to as halorespiration. And the fifth physiological role is anaerobic co-metabolism. This usually involves reduced enzyme cofactors in anaerobic microorganisms. If you look on the right-hand column, you'll see abbreviations for each of these physiological roles. You don't have to memorize them. I'll help remind you when we talk about them again. Then finally, the objective eventually is to take this knowledge and somehow apply it for bioremediation. Here's a simple scheme that was first devised by Teach in 1993. I'm sorry if I didn't mention that I'm on slide 14 now. This is a scheme that shows you the general strategies towards bioremediation. There are basically three components involved in any remediation, in any bioremediation. That is the environment, which is shown on the bottom right in the orange square. the microorganisms shown on the bottom left in the other orange square, and in the top is the contaminant in question, the substrate or the pollutant. Now we have three interactions between these components. The most important interaction, which is used in bioremediation, is the interaction between the microorganism and the environment. That interaction can be referred to as physiological requirements. Most bioremediation strategies then try to improve environmental conditions for microorganisms already existing in the field by determining what's needed, if we have to add more electron donor or if we have to add more electron acceptor, provide nutrients or other kinds of environment, improve other kinds of environmental factors. This is the type of strategy that's used in most bioremediation cases. The second one I'd like to talk about is bioaugmentation. That's the that works against the interaction between the microorganism and the substrate. So if we are missing an organism that has the right kind of enzymes at a site, we might want to consider adding a strain of microorganisms that does have the right kind of enzymes to achieve the biodegradation. And so this addition of the microorganisms is referred to as bioaugmentation. Then the last interaction is the interaction between the substrate and the environment. This has to do with the bioavailability and the mobility of the compound. In this particular case, we might be able to improve matters by adding surfactants, co-solvents, in the case of metals, chelators, to improve the mobility or dissolution of the substrate. Now I'm moving on to slide 15. I'm going to come to the major focus of my talk. I decided to spend more time talking about chloroethenes because if we look at all the contaminated sites in the United States, this is definitely the largest market share, is the chlorinated ethenes, so I'm going to spend the most time talking about them. Towards the end of the talk, I'll speak a little bit on the matter of chlorinated methanes. These are the abbreviations that I'll be using. You can see them on slide 15. I think they're pretty much similar to what most people use, so I don't think there's a problem there. On slide 16 now, I'm giving you in one snapshot an overview of everything that we learned about the biodegradation of chloroethenes in one slide. What we've done is we've divided it now into the five physiological categories, and using color coding here and the size of the abbreviations, that sort of indicates the rate at which it's being degraded. So if you see big white letters, that means that the rates are very rapid. If you see tiny blue letters, that means the rates are very slow. The red letters means that it's not completely certain what's going on. So we see that in the case of under aerobic conditions, chlorinated ethenes that are actually used as a carbon and energy source under aerobic conditions, we have good examples of that for vinyl chloride, some examples of that for cis-dietic chloroethene, but we don't have any examples of that for TCE and PCE. In terms of co-metabolism under aerobic conditions, we have very rapid co-metabolism of vinyl chloride, dichloroethene, and TCE, and there's not hardly any evidence or very good evidence at all for fully chlorinated PCE. There's not very good evidence for the use of any chlorinated ethenes as an electron donor under anaerobic conditions. There's some sporadic reports here and there, but nothing really conclusive. There's very good evidence for anaerobic respiration. So now I'm on the fourth line that says EAAN. This refers to the use of chlorinated ethenes as electron acceptors under anaerobic conditions. We have very good evidence that these compounds are used as electron acceptors, very fast rates for PCE and TCE, but also appreciable rates for the lower chlorinated ethenes as well, including vinyl chloride and cis dichloroethene. And all of the chlorinitazines are also co-metabolized under anaerobic conditions. Now I'm at the lowest bullet here now, except that co-metabolism is much slower than hollow respiration. That's why I colored these in blue and made them smaller letters. Okay, now I'm moving on to slide 17, and I'm going to give some examples of each of these physiological groups. In terms of degradation of chloroethenes as electron donors under aerobic conditions, so this is when aerobic microorganisms actually use the chloroethenes as a food source to gain energy and grow. We have very good evidence for that with vinyl chloride. There are many examples of organisms that have been isolated that can do that. They come for the most part from the three genera that are shown here, Mycobacterium, Mycocardioides, and Pseudomonas. There's been a lot of work on the pathway involved here in recent years. The best depiction of the pathway shown was reported by Colbin and Spain in 2003. Basically, we see that vinyl chloride, the degradation of vinyl chloride is initiated with a monooxygenase. We form as the first product in the epoxy alkane shown here. Then at that point, we get substitution of coenzyme M into the molecule, and then the compound gets further oxidized and completely mineralized to CO2. It was kind of unusual that in this particular pathway that coenzyme M was involved, because previously to this report, coenzyme M was only known in methanogens, organisms that produce methane gas. In terms of kinetics, the kinetics are quite good. We have rates all the way up to one per day, which means that the doubling times are slightly less than one day. The specific activities range all the way up to almost 5 grams being converted per gram of cells per day. And in terms of the half saturation or the half velocity constants, we see that some of those are very low, all the way down to 70 parts per billion. Now I'm moving on to slide 18. Now we're going to consider the co-oxidation of chlorinated ethenes. There are many microorganisms implicated in this. I couldn't possibly give you a full list because it just covered the whole slide. Here are some of the most important examples. Methane oxidizing bacteria, alkane degrading bacteria, ammonia oxidizing bacteria, among others. The pathway is shown here. Basically also in this pathway we have the involvement of monooxygenase. So all these organisms are growing on other substrates to form monooxygenase for the degradation of those substrates. And the main initial product in these reactions is the corresponding epoxide. In this particular example, we see TCE being converted to TCE epoxide. TCE epoxide is not very stable. It starts falling apart, and it falls apart into organic acids that can be further degraded. We have some other products, some minor products, such as chloral, shown here, and those are eventually metabolized via the chlorinated acetic acids. Now I'm moving on to slide 19. To support co-oxidation, it's necessary to have a primary substrate that for which it's necessary that monooxygenase is utilized for the degradation of that primary substrate. And some classic examples of primary substrates that support co-oxidation are shown here: methane, toluene, phenol. All three of the first examples there have been used in bioremediation to support co-oxidation in the field. And some other ones that people are beginning to recognize also are ammonium, ethane, propane. Some of these latter ones are interesting, like ethene might be interesting for natural attenuation because we might get formation of ethene, and then on the fringe of the plume we get aerobic conditions, then the ethene can then be used to support co-oxidation. On the lower part of slide 19, you'll see the kinetics. We have a large range of kinetics going all the way from 57 to 55,000 milligrams of chlorinated solvent being converted per gram of biomass per day. The highest rates here, the one that corresponds to 55,000, refers to monooxygenases, the methane. We have a large range of half velocity constants that range from 400 parts per billion up to about 30 parts per million. I'm now moving on to slide 20. Now I'm going to talk about hollow respiration of chlorinated ethenes. Basically, hollow respiration involves successive steps of reductive hydrogenolysis. So we go from PCE to TCE to cis-DCE, vinyl chloride, and eventually ethene. Each case, we have two electrons being pumped into the molecule and replacing a chlorine for a hydrogen. Now, in this part, what we globally see is we can break it down into two phases. We see as we go from PCE to cis-DCE, there's a high level of biodiversity. They're hollow respiring microorganisms that can do the first part from PCE to cis-DCE. These organisms have been isolated from seven different genera, coming from four major bacterial phyla, so that means that the capacity is widely distributed in the bacterial world. However, the final stage, going from cis-DCE all the way down to ethene, there's very low biodiversity. We see that up till now, strains have only been isolated from one genus that can do that. On slide 21, you can see the names of the bacterial genera that are involved in the processes. So in the initial part, going from PCE to cis-DCE, you can see the different hollow respiring bacteria that are involved. On the right-hand side, in the yellow letters, you can see the electron donors that these microorganisms use. Some of these microorganisms have very restrictive electron donors. They can only use hydrogen, and others are more flexible in the kinds of electron donors they can use, like some can use either hydrogen or lactate or ethanol. There's only one that doesn't like to use hydrogen, that's desulfuromonas, and it prefers to use acetate. So that's the upper part is the high biodiversity part, going from PCE to cis-DCE. On the lower part, we see that the one genus that's implicated in the low biodiversity part, going from cis-DCE all the way through to ethene is restricted to this one genus, strains to this one genus, D. halococoides. I'm now moving on to slide 22. In terms of the biochemistry, all of these halorespiring reactions are catalyzed by very specific reductive dehalogenases. They're quite diverse. There are many different kinds. They do all, however, share one characteristic that they all seem to contain vitamin B12, and most of them are are membrane bound. In terms of kinetics, the kinetics of PCE to TCE and or cis-DCE are relatively fast. We have growth rates all the way up to 6.6 per day, which means the doubling times are very short. And the activities go all the way up to 37 grams of chlorinated solvent being processed by each gram of cells per day. Now, if we look to the second part, going from vinyl chloride to ethene or cis-dichloroethene to ethene, we see that the growth rates are much slower and the specific activities are almost tenfold lower. And here we have some data about the half saturation, the half velocity constants. They're down in the 700 part per billion range. Now I'm moving on to slide 23. What we see a lot of times at sites is that when we have a chlorinated ethene site with PCE or TCE, it's quite common that if there's also natural organic matter or other kinds of organic matter through co-contamination, it's quite common at these sites that we see rapid development of the conversion of PCE to cis-DCE, and then it takes a really long time before we see that the cis-DCE is then further converted to SE. Now, there's a reason for this, and that has to do with microbial growth kinetics. So I'm going to show you a hypothetical example here in slides 23 and 24. For this hypothetical example, let's assume that we hardly have any bacteria that can do this on the site. So we're just going to assume that we only have one bacterium per cubic meter of groundwater that has the right kind of activity. We're going to assume that starting at time zero, we're going to provide the ideal conditions for growth. That means that there's going to be electron donor present on the site, the temperature is going to be okay, the pH is going to be okay, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to compare then D. halococoides, an example of a strain that's able to convert cis dichloroethene to ethene, or vinyl chloride to ethene, actually. And we're going to compare that to a really fast-growing halorespira to convert PCE to cis-DCE, D. halos spirillum. Here you can see the growth rates. We're comparing a growth rate of 6.65 per day with 0.4 per day. And there you have the specific activities of these bacteria. You see the growth equation at the bottom of slide 23. Now we're going to move over to slide 24. And then the question is how long will it take at this site for the cells to grow up to a point where we can expect a conversion of 10 milligrams per liter of chloroethenes per day? So based on the idea that we only had one bacterium per cubic meter of groundwater, that means that we only have 1 times 10 to the minus 15th grams of that bacterium per liter of groundwater. And then when you make this analysis, then what we see then, it only takes a matter of a few days to get an active population of D. halos spirillum. So it only takes a few days to get the microorganisms there that can convert the PCE to cis-DCE. But it takes much longer to get the microorganisms there that are going to do the final polishing of cis-DCE or vinyl chloride all the way through to ethene. And this hypothetical example would take 72 days. Moving on to slide 25. Now we're going to consider the anaerobic co-metabolism of chloroethenes. The microorganisms that are involved are usually methanogens or acetogens, the kind of microorganisms you would find in anaerobic sludge, for instance. Here, too, the pathway is just the same as in halorespiration. It's successive steps of reductive hydrogenolysis. Reactions seem to be catalyzed not by enzymes, but by reduced enzyme cofactors, such as vitamin B12, or in the case of methanogens, a nickel-containing cofactor referred to as factor 430. The kinetics are very slow. If you were to move back a couple of slides and compare these rates to what we just saw with halorespiration, you would appreciate that the kinetics of anaerobic co-metabolism are on the order of 3 orders to 4 orders of magnitude slower. So you don't necessarily have to have D. halococoides to get the complete conversion to ethene. If you're patient and you can wait at these much slower rates with co-metabolism, you can also get those kind of compounds. But the rates are very slow, so most people would prefer to use halorespiration and bioremediation. Okay, now I'm going to discuss two major strategies that are used for chloroethene bioremediation. The first strategy would be, since we realize that the conversion of PCE to cis-DCE is rather quick under anaerobic conditions, so we'd go initially for first rapid reductive dehalogenation to TCE and cis-DCE, and then for the slower part, we, instead of continuing the anaerobic conditions, then we would switch over to aerobic conditions and try to promote aerobic co-oxidation of TCE and cis-DCE to CO2 and chloride. So you can see the proposed pathway in the blue, where PCE is first converted to cis-DCE under anaerobic conditions, and then subsequently, with addition of the primary substrate to support co-metabolism, we have the conversion of cis-DCE to CO2 and chloride. The second strategy would be to have the complete anaerobic degradation. In order to achieve this, then, we have to have on the site microorganisms in the genus of D. halococoides that are capable of converting cis DCE or vinyl chloride to ethene. In this case, it would be just completely anaerobic. We'd have to add electron donor. And if we have no evidence of D. halococoides on the site, we'd have to ensure that they're added to make sure they're present on the site. Okay, now I'm moving over to slide 27, which is an example of a real-scale bioremediation that was conducted in Breda, Holland, using the first strategy where we had first anaerobic stage and second an aerobic stage. This was a site contaminated, a dry cleaner contaminated site. There was a Dean apple. They had an in-situ treatment right above the Dean apple, and they used methanol as the electron donor, and they just recirculated the water every time it was recirculated. They add more methanol to the water and injected it down into the groundwater. In the second part, which is on the right of the graph, downstream from the Dean apple, then they had all the products from the initial anaerobic transformation, which was mainly cis dichloroethene. And this part then, they injected phenol and air into the groundwater to promote the co-oxidation of cis DCE with microorganisms that were oxidizing phenol. On the next slide, in slide 28, you can see a summary of the results. In the anaerobic zone, in the first 6 months, there was 85% removal of the PCE. In that same zone, the chloride concentration went from 1 millimolar to 6 millimolar, which is very good evidence that there was reductive dehalogenation. Downstream in the anaerobic zone in the groundwater, all of the cis dichloroethene and vinyl chloride that was generated in the anaerobic zone, as well as all of the injected phenol, was removed. And in terms of total mass of the chloroethenes, it decreased from 1,500 moles to 550 moles in the six-month period. Now I'm moving on to slide 29 to show an example of a full-scale remediation and using the second strategy, where we have complete anaerobic treatment. This is from a study by Lenvin et al. From 2003. What you see here are the plots used out in the field. There is on the bottom of this figure, you see the control and biostimulation plot. So that part of the field was used to see what would happen if you did nothing except recirculate the water. That was tested for about 140 days. Then for the subsequent 121 days, they tried just adding electron donor as the only measure, just to see if they could stimulate the degradation by adding the electron donor only. Then as comparison, they had the bioaugmentation plot, which is shown on the upper part of this figure here. And that one, they added the electron donor, plus they added D. halococoides to try to promote the last stages of reductive dechlorination to ethene. Okay, I'm going to show you the results now on slide 30. On slide 30, you have the control experiment. This is when they just recirculated the groundwater. That's all they did. It's just a control to show you what would have happened if they did nothing. So what you see here is that at this site, already natural attenuation occurred, and most of the PCE was already converted to DCE. So in this control experiment, basically the ratio between the DCE and the PCE stayed more or less constant for 136 days. You could see that there was a little bit of continued natural attenuation, a little bit more PCE was converted to DCE, but that wasn't really that much, just a little bit. Then in slide 31, we can see the results from the biostimulation plot. So this is the one where they added lactic acid as an electron donor, and we can see here that after they added lactic acid, it took almost 100 days before anything appreciable happened. you see that on the bar that corresponds to day 107, is when you see that there's some growth in the amount of vinyl chloride and a decrease in the amount of cis-dichloroethene. Then as we continue on for a couple more weeks, and that rapidly the cis-DC decreases, and we are seeing now both vinyl chloride and ethene being formed. Finally, on day 121, 76% of the dichloroethene was converted to ethene. Okay, so you can see that the time scale here, it took about 100 days for that for a population of dehalococcoides to come in and finally convert dichloroethene to ethene. What happens if we actually add the dehalococcoides, as shown on slide 32? In this slide is the bioaugmentation plot. This is run very similar to the previous one. It's a different location in the field, so we have a slightly different composition. We have more PCE in this one. As you look at the one that's at day minus 29, you can see that the initial material actually contains PCE and DCE. On time zero is when they started adding the lactic acid, and they also added dehalococcoides, the bacteria, into the groundwater, and you can see then that they had a faster conversion of the cis-DCE to vinyl chloride and eventually ethene, such that by day 43, 92% was converted into ethene. And now I'm moving on to slide 33. Because this is a group that's interested in DNAPLS, I included two slides discussing some issues of how microorganisms can interact with DNAPLS. What you see on slide 33 is a dissolution equation. A really important part of the dissolution equation is the part that's in parentheses on the right-hand side. CS refers to the maximum aqueous solubility. CB refers to the actual concentration of the compound in question. The difference between those two terms is the driving force of dissolution. So biodegradation can enhance dissolution because it can increase this term. It can lower the CB, the actual concentration, and make the driving force greater. And then there are some experimental results. They're shown here in the lower part of slide 33. First and foremost is the observation by Yang and McCarty in the year 2000 that PCE dehalogenation was feasible at saturated concentration, so it's possible to have microorganisms growing right against the DNAPL. They don't seem to be disturbed by the completely saturated concentrations of PCE. Then in the two studies below that, we have one experimental evidence that with bioremediation it was possible to have a 16-time faster dissolution rate of the DNAPL. And then in a recently published article from Christ et al. In 2005, they have a model where they can demonstrate that they can expect maybe a five-fold increase in the dissolution rate due to actively degrading microorganisms right against the DNAPL. And now I'm moving to slide 34. There's a lot of interest for combining surfactants. So this is playing into Steve Magnin's introduction, combining physical chemical with biological treatment. There's a lot of interest for flushing or cleaning out DNAPL sites with surfactants and co-solvents. I'd like to point out here that if we carefully choose our surfactants so that they're biodegradable, then that can work to our advantage because then the residual PCE remaining in the site after flushing, it's possible then to have that be biodegraded using the surfactants that also are residual after the flushing as the electron donor. And also it's important just to have any residual surfactants be degraded so they're not left behind. Now I'm moving to slide 35. I have a few more slides left, and these are referring to some observations about the degradation of chloromethanes. What you see here, my abbreviation system for chloromethanes. Okay, then on slide 36, you see a global overview of what we learned about biodegradation of the chlorinated methane series. We see that both chloromethane and dichloromethane are readily used as electron donors under aerobic conditions. We see that chloromethane, dichloromethane, and chloroform are all rapidly co-oxidized under aerobic conditions. And under anaerobic conditions, there's very good evidence that both chloromethane and dichloromethane are rapidly degraded without oxygen as electron donors supporting microbial growth. There's a hole in the market in terms of HALA respiration of chlorinated methanes. There's no, to my knowledge, there's no organism that's been isolated that can HALA respire any of these chlorinated methanes. So that's an interesting hole in the research that needs to be filled. And then finally, at the very bottom of this page, you see the co-metabolism. There is very good evidence for co-metabolism of dichloromethane, chloroform, and carbon tetrachloride. But you see from the small blue letters that these rates are relatively low compared to the other rates that are shown above. Now, what are the microorganisms involved? Now, an actual bioremediation of the higher chloridated methanes, such as carbon tetrachloride and chloroform, most of the bioremediation work has gone with co-metabolism under anaerobic conditions, so I'm just going to speak about that today. There are many types of microorganisms involved, ranging from methanogens, acetogens, fermentative bacteria, sulfate reducers, iron reducers, and even denitrifying bacteria have all been implicated in the anaerobic co-metabolism of chloroform and carbon tetrachloride. There seem to be two pathways involved. One involves reductive hydrogenolysis. That's when we get the continual replacement of chloride atoms with hydrogen atoms. But we also see good evidence also for hydrolytic reduction. That's when we get that carbene radical that reacts with water and then forms hydrolyzed products. In the pathways of co-metabolism, we see that there are many things involved. A common denominator is that there are reduced enzyme cofactors or metabolites that are produced by the microorganisms that are actually physically causing the reactions. In some cases, we see that reduced minerals that are formed are actually producing the reactions, such as, for example, at the very bottom of this page, you see biogenic magnetite. So in some cases, we see that the microorganisms just produce a certain kind of mineral that's very reactive, and it's the mineral itself that actually does the reaction. Now I'm moving on to slide 38. Here you can see the range of specific activities that we observed. Chloroform is relatively slow, only going up to about 36 milligrams per gram dry weight per day. We're getting a little bit faster rates with carbon tetrachloride, going all the way up to about 1,200 milligrams per gram dry weight of cells per day. I'm moving now to slide 39. Here you see the two competing pathways. On the left-hand side, we see the reductive hydrogenolysis, in which the chlorines are successfully replaced by hydrogen atoms. To the right-hand side, we see the pathway involving hydrolytic reduction. We get the formation of the carbene radical that then goes on and reacts with water to form organic acids and carbon monoxides that are then subsequently metabolized to CO2. I have a couple slides here just to show you some results about the importance of redox-mediating compounds in this process. Here you'll see the experimental setup where we have the small serum bottle with some sludge. We have an anaerobic headspace. We're adding 100 micromolars of carbon tetrachloride, and we're testing the effect of certain redox-mediating compounds at 1/10 molar concentration, so 10 micromolar. On slide 41, you can see the structures of the redox-mediating compounds that we tested. We tested vitamin B12, riboflavin, and we a model quinone compound referred to as AQDS. I'm on slide 42. On this slide, you can see the effect of these redox-mediating compounds. First and foremost, you'll see the white bullets at the top. That's just if you incubate the media alone, there's no loss of the carbon tetrachloride. That's kind of like the control. then the black round bullets where it says no redox mediator, that's what would have happened if we just had the complete medium, but we don't add any redox mediator. We see we get degradation, but it's slow. And then the triangles, diamonds, and squares are the examples of when we add 10 micromolar of these different redox mediating compounds. We see that in all cases when we add the redox mediators, the degradation rates are increased. But the best redox mediating compound was the vitamin B12 with a really dramatic increase in the degradation rate. On slide 43, you can see the chlorine balance on day 5. We can see then that if we didn't add any redox mediating compounds, that some of our product is chloroform, that's the purple stuff, and some of our product is chloride, the yellow stuff. We see chloroform formation when we use AQDS and riboflavin as a redox mediator, because you can see that in the purple. But if we use two forms of vitamin B12, we hardly get any chloroform formation at all, and we mostly get the desired product, which is inorganic chloride. Now I'm moving to slide 44. This shows you what we think is happening with redox mediation. We have bacteria that's oxidizing the substrate. It's reducing the redox mediating compound. In this particular example, we're showing you how it's reducing a quinone, forming a hydroquinone. Then the hydroquinone goes on and actually reacts with the chlorinated methanes. And then in slide 45, you see evidence from the literature where hydroquinone was shown to directly chemically reduce carbon tetrachloride to a small amount of chloroform and a large amount of inorganic chloride. And then now I'm on slide 46, the conclusions of my talk. Regarding the biodegradation of chloroethenes, we see that there's a high biodiversity for the rapid Hall respiration of PCE to cis-DCE. However, the second part, going from cis-DCE all the way through to ethene, is restricted to one genus and seems to be occurring at about tenfold lower rates. We see that there's slow anaerobic co-metabolism of PCE, TCE, of all the chlorinated ethenes under anaerobic conditions. However, these rates are anywhere from 3 orders of magnitude to 4 orders of magnitude slower than Hall respiration. Rapid aerobic co-oxidation of vinyl chloride, cis dichloroethene, and TCE, that's feasible. What's not feasible, though, is the co-oxidation of the fully chlorinated PCE. And then what's not known to most people but is actually becoming recognized recently is that it's possible to get aerobic biodegradation of vinyl chloride as a growth substrate. And there's a lot of new evidence now for all kinds of different strains that can do that. So, like for vinyl chloride and maybe even for cis-chloroethene, it may not be necessary anymore to just have co-metabolism. You might be able to just have pure aerobic growth. Concerning the biomediation of chloroethenes, we reviewed two processes, one in which we go for the complete anaerobic reductive dechlorination with dehalococcoides, and the second one is which we have a first an anaerobic stage going from PCE to cis-DCE, then followed by aerobic co-oxidation to CO2 and chloride. And then this is my last slide, some concluding remarks about chloromethanes. We see that the rapid aerobic as well as rapid anaerobic biodegradation of the two lower chlorinated methanes, so chloromethane and dichloromethane, is feasible as growth substrates. We see that there's also possible to have rapid aerobic co-oxidation of everything all the way through to chloroform, but not for carbon tetrachloride. In terms of the higher chlorinated methane, so chloroform and carbon tetrachloride, it's only possible to degrade, for instance, carbon tetrachloride with the slow anaerobic metabolism. We see that for chloroform and carbon tetrachloride, that redox mediating compounds can greatly enhance that kind of co-metabolism. And so far, the only bioremediation that's been practiced for these chloroform and for carbon tetrachloride is using this anaerobic co-metabolic approach. So that's my talk. I appreciate your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Field. That was a very interesting presentation. We'd like to go to questions and answers from the audience in just a minute. Let me remind the phone participants one more time. You can put your phone on mute. If you don't have a mute button, you can press *6, and that will mute your line. And then if you have a question, you can unmute your line by pressing *6 again. We'll alternate between questions from the Internet participants. If you aren't familiar with the system, the Internet participants, there's a question mark button at the top of your slides. If you click that button, you'll get a little form, and you can type in your question, and I'll read that out to today's presenters. Phone participants, if you could, if you have a question, you can take your phone off mute. Please introduce yourself and name your organization, and then go ahead and ask your question. At this time, I'd like to ask the phone participants, if anyone has a question, you'd go ahead and take your phone off mute. Please introduce yourself and name your organization.
Hi, Jim. This is Steve Mangin again. I noticed you've mentioned bioenhancement after cold solvent or surfactant flushing. Do you know of any work underway to study what happens to the biology after you do a thermal remedy, whether it be with steam or with electric heating?
I'm not aware of any studies that have looked into that, but if you use the steam or heating, then you're basically going to knock out a large part of the population. You're pretty much only going to be left over with spore-forming microorganisms. So those are microorganisms that can tolerate some heat. Maybe the cells die, but their spores will survive. So when the heat is not applied anymore, then the spores will germinate. And then in that way, you're kind of selecting then for spore-forming microorganisms. So in that regard, then I don't think D. halococoides is a spore-forming microorganism. So that way, you're going to knock out a really important important player. You might be able to continue to have degradation of PCE to cis-PCE because some of the ones that involved in that first part there were spore-formers, like Clostridium, for instance, is a spore-forming microorganism, and it's also known as a microorganism that can dehalogenate PCE to cis-PCE.
Thanks. Let's. Or Steve, do you have another question?
Not at the moment. I thought that would pass for a minute.
We'll check with you again. Let me check again with the other phone participants. If you take your phone off mute, please introduce yourself and name your organization. Okay, I do have a. Larry Reed has a question. Let's go ahead and let Larry ask his question.
Dr. Field, just a quick question for you. In the middle of the presentation, you mentioned the application of bioremediation of the dry cleaner in Breda, Holland. Do you know if that same technology or same approach has been used in the United States?
I'm not aware of it. There was a review article that was written in the year 2002, where they've listed all the full-scale bioremediations. I can take a look in there and see if they had any mention of a similar kind of thing, and I'll get back to you about that one. But I'm personally not aware. I think most of the United States, people have gone, at TCE sites, they've gone possibly with co-oxidation sometimes, but at PCE sites, I'm mostly aware of situations where people have just gone for this straightforward reductive dehalogenation.
I'll take a question now from one of our Internet participants. The question is from Jim Jay at the Ontario Ministry of the Environment in Toronto. What methods do you use to add microorganisms to the natural environment to enhance bioremediation?
Okay, now the case of D. halococoides, what you can do is you can go to a site where these microorganisms are actively present, and you can just withdraw some well water from that site, and then you can go to a site where it's not present, and you can inject the well water in. So that's one approach that you can take. So you just go to a site where you know the organisms are active, get some well water and inject it in, and a site where you know they're not active and inject it in. That would be the most economical approach. An important thing to realize is that the organisms grow, so you don't have to add that many. You just have to add a little bit, and if you provide the right environmental conditions, they'll start growing. In the hypothetical example I showed you here, we looked at a hypothetical example just starting with one bacteria per cubic meter of water, and in that particular example, it took 70 days to get a really active population. So if you, instead of adding just one bacteria, were to add a couple hundred or a couple thousand, then it probably wouldn't take all those 70 days, but take less time.
Okay, I've got another question here from an internet participant. This is from James Schutz and Parsons from Buffalo, New York. His question is, what are the most appropriate tests for Dahalococcoides?
Okay, pretty much commercially available now are tests that are based on phylogenetic tests that are based on 16S ribosome genes. So those are genes that are used to classify microorganisms. So that's a good indicator. It's not necessarily conclusive, but it's a fairly good indicator. Much better indicators that are still under development are ones that are going to look for the actual genes involved in the dehalogenation. So in the future, we'll probably have tests that will be testing the actual reductive dehalogenation genes rather than the 16S ribosome genes. But it's pretty much standard practice that people will send samples out for the 16S ribosome genes and have it determined if there's dehalocoides present. That seems to be pretty much standard practice these days.
Okay, let me check back with the phone participants. If anyone has another question, take your phone off mute and introduce yourself and name your organization. Okay, we're ready to move on to the next presenter in just a moment. I would like to mention that those of you who have additional questions submitted online, I'll be forwarding those to today's presenters, and we will make sure that you get an answer so you can continue to submit more questions. Phone participants, we will be coming back to another question and answer period after Dr. Newman's presentation. And hopefully we'll have a little bit of time at the end if Dr. Field remains with us. We may be able to work in more questions for him as well. Let me just mention also that we are scheduled for 4 o'clock. It's in fact likely at this point that we'll run over at least a couple or few minutes. But we will shut down by about 4:10, I'd say, at the latest. So let me turn it back over to Steve Manjin to introduce today's second presenter.
Hi, this is Steve again, and as you may know, Dr. Lee Newman is at the University of South Carolina. She'll be speaking to us about phytoremediation techniques. And again, I will, of course, be very much interested in seeing how the use of phytoremediation is working out in the field, since again, I always think of trees as being a non-invasive kind of remediation technique. I recognize it's more than trees. Please take it away, Dr. Newman.
Thank you very much. Well, we're running kind of late, so I'm going to start in right away. So the first slide, slide number 48, what is phytoremediation? And I have to say that I have been around in the field of phytoremediation long enough that, and now I can't get my slides to work. My computer just froze up. Anyway, I printed them out. That when I started, there was enough people who thought they were being extremely funny and would ask me, what does phyto have to do with it, meaning dogs? And it has absolutely nothing to do with it. Phyto comes from the Latin word for plant or green, and we were using the trees to do this. However, a colleague of mine gave probably the best definition or the best explanation of phytoremediation that I've heard for a while. And that was to think about the story of the blind man and the elephant. And the blind men, as you remember in the story, went up to an elephant, and one felt the trunk, and one felt the leg, and one felt the side, and they had different views of it. So one said, no, an elephant is like a snake, and no, an elephant is like a tree trunk, or no, an elephant is like a wall. And that's pretty much what phytoremediation is. Phytoremediation is what you need it to be and where you're coming from when you're looking at it. So engineers tend to think of phytoremediation as a solar-driven pump and treat system. Microbiologists tend to look at phytoremediation as a biological system for nourishing bacteria in the soils. And other people who look at plants as the green liver concept might assume that a plant is a biological, a green system for degrading contaminants, similar to what a mammalian liver would do. So if we skip ahead to slide number 50, it has a list of a whole bunch of types of phytoremediation, and I can tell you honestly that not one of these did I come up with a name for them. However, if you go into the literature, you will find literally dozens of names for types of phytoremediation, and they are all very descriptive, talking about the types of contaminants that are being dealt with or the types of media that are being remediated. So you can have phytoextraction is pulling metals out of soil, while rhizofiltration is using the roots, the rhizo, to filter water and remove metals from that. You can have the rhizosphere enhancement, where again you're using the roots or the rhizo portion of the plant to nourish the bacteria in the soil. On slide 51, it shows a wide range of contaminants that can that have been treated using phytoremediation. Some of these are still in laboratory studies. Others have been actually moved out into the field and been applied on some of these. So you can see that there's a wide range of both organics and inorganic contaminants that can be treated with phytoremediation. On slide 52, it shows the different types of impacted media that can be treated. And again, we can look at soil, sediments, water runoff, stormwater, groundwater, air purification of greenhouse gases on VOCs. So depending on the process of the plants that you're looking at, you can treat a wide range of contaminants and in a wide range of impacted media. Slide 53 shows a lot of the advantages of phytoremediation. Some of the ones that I think are most important is that under safety issues, having a good plant crop on your site will control erosion, it will control runoff, it limits rainwater infiltration, lowers dust emissions. Ecologically, it is very habitat friendly. It increases biodiversity on the sites. Now, if you're working on a brownfield site, this may not be very important. However, a lot of sites that are being worked on are military bases that are being closed down, and they're trying to convert these back into public lands that could be used as parkland for housing developments, or land that would be converted back to the natural state that it was before the military had their bases there. From the regulator and the public side of it, there is a very large level of acceptance, especially in the general public. And this is because, as people look at it, if they have a choice between having a pump and treat system with a building and a pump and it's clanking away over there, or a grove of trees, the general public is going to prefer looking at the trees. So there's a big level of acceptance, a high level of acceptance. But on the other hand, on slide number 54, you're going to see that there are also limitations or common regulatory issues that you're going to deal with phytoremediation. The first one is very, very important, although there are ways around a lot of these, and we'll talk about them later. And the first one is depth. If the plants can't reach the contaminant, if the roots can't extend down and reach the contaminant and interact with the contaminant in some way, it's not going to be effective. It takes a long period of time for the plants to become established, and it is not a fast treatment process. Now, one of the things to keep in mind is that you have to put this in perspective. If you're comparing phytoremediation to excavation and incineration, it is going to be a long treatment system. If you're comparing it to traditional pump and treat systems, where you're looking at removing the water and treating it at some level, it may not take any longer than a traditional pump and treat system for groundwater. On slide 55, we have phytotoxicity, and this can be a very big issue, not as much for groundwater contamination, but certainly for soil contamination, that if the ground is so toxic that the plants die, you're not going to have a very effective treatment system. And then there is always the potential of media transfer or food chain impact. So are you taking the contaminant out of the groundwater and just pumping it into the atmosphere? Are you accumulating it into the plant? And what happens if insects or animals start munching on the plant? So these are things that can be limitations and have regulatory concern when you're considering phytoremediation. Now, the next couple of slides, I'm not going to go over them. They're basically information slides for you. So there are web addresses where you can get information, books that have been published on phytoremediation, a list of some companies that are basically focusing on phytoremediation as their treatment strategies, journals that publish phytoremediation articles, and conferences that have phytoremediation sessions or are strictly phytoremediation conferences. So if we skip ahead to slide number 61, what we're basically dealing with here today is phytodegradation, or the use of plants to degrade organic contaminants from the groundwater. On slide 62, we're talking about the enzyme system. And again, what I mentioned previously, a lot of people look at plants as a green liver, that the same type of enzymes that are found in a mammalian liver system, which is involved in the degradation of xenobiotic compounds, these same type of enzymes have been found in plant systems. So you can have things like cytochrome P450s, peroxidases, glutathione S-transferases, conjugation enzymes, and all of these can play a role in the degradation or sequestration of contaminants within the plant system. And we are only at the very beginning of understanding how these different enzymes work within the plant system to degrade these organic contaminants. Now, as the previous speaker went over in great detail, degradation of chlorinated solvents, and we're going to talk about TCE for a little bit here, has been well known for a number of years. But if you look on slide 64 at the mammalian degradation pathways, you can see that these are much, much more complex, and you can have literally dozens of metabolites that show up from exposure to a compound like TCE. Now, one of the things that I should just take a little aside to say here is that I consider myself very lucky that I have the opportunity to do both the laboratory studies, proof of concept of what are the plants doing with these contaminants, are they able to do anything with these contaminants, and understanding this at both the protein, the enzyme, and the genetic level. And I also have the opportunity to go out and install several sites, install phytoremediation as the technology of choice for cleaning up these sites. So we're going to start with some of the very basic laboratory studies, move up to a field demonstration, and then some actual applications. So in the beginning, we started with cell cultures, where we were growing cells of poplars in this case, kind of like you would grow a bacterial culture in a flask, and the cell, individual cells are just swirling around in there. And when we exposed these cells to trichloroethylene, what we found was that we were able to see the same types of metabolites, or I should say the same metabolites, that you would expect to see from a mammalian system, particularly di- and trichloroacetic acid and trichloroethanol. And we were also able to see degradation of these compounds all the way down to carbon dioxide, which was very promising for us. We also did greenhouse studies, and photos of this are on slide 66. And again, when we looked at this, we saw these compounds showing up. One of the things that was very interesting about this was that we did not see the same compounds throughout the plant. So in the root systems, we see primarily the dichloroacetic acid. When you get up into the leaves, it's primarily the trichloroacetic acid. So there seems to be different pathways for breakdown of these compounds in different tissues of the plants, which is really kind of fascinating. Now, I don't have a lot of data on these slides. If anyone is interested in getting copies of the journal articles that have the data and describe these experiments in more detail, please feel free to send me an email and I will send you out copies of these articles. Now, originally, we were getting a lot of funding from the chemical industry, particularly Occidental Chemical, to try to develop these technologies for cleaning up contaminated sites. And our original goal was that we wanted to get out onto a site, plant the trees, and we're going to go running ahead and prove that phytoremediation works. But Occidental Chemical had a very, very good project manager who worked with us, and his comment was that if we go out into the field, there are going to be so many variables that we're never going to be able to prove conclusively what is happening out there, that we are not going to be able to control the groundwater flow or the concentration in the groundwater or the amount of rain that's hitting the site, and we're not going to be able to have a mass balance in the field. So what Occidental Chemical did is constructed a series of artificial aquifer cells for us, and these are shown in slide number 67. These cells were approximately 12 foot wide by 20 foot long. On the injection end where you see the injection well, it was about 4 feet deep. On the extraction well, it was about 4.5 feet deep. The bottom had a sand gravel layer that would serve as our artificial aquifer, topped by 3.5 to 4 feet of soil where we would grow the plants. If we put contaminated water into this artificial aquifer through our injection well, it had a residence time of about 1.5 days before it would come out the other end. Slide number 67 shows these cells. They were double-walled polyethylene-lined cells. You can see in the top photo that there were monitoring ports between the two walls of the cells so that if we had any type of leaks, we could shut the system down and pump it out so we would not contaminate the environment there. Slide number 68 shows the injection well, so you have an idea of what it looked like, and the trees when we first put them in. Now, one of the things that we did in this is the original experiment had 4 cells that we were using. The first cell had trees and just water in it, so these were our control trees. The next 2 cells had trees that received water-containing TCE at about 18 parts per million. So this is well above regulatory limits. The last cell, the 4th cell, was our control, another control, and this had no trees in it, but received the exact same amount of TCE-containing water as the 2 cells with trees. Now, we tried to maintain the amount of water so that there was always about 6 to 8 inches of water at the bottom of our artificial aquifer cell system. So as you can imagine, the trees took up an awful lot of water, and we pumped very little out of the cells, out of the injection well or the extraction well. However, the cell that had no trees had very little water loss, and we pumped huge volumes out of that so that on a daily basis we were maintaining that 6 to 8 inches. Okay, slide number 70 shows our first year of data on this system. And as you can see, the bars that have for the cell that had no trees, we started recovering TCE and metabolites from the system, and it slowly increased throughout the growing season. However, the 2 cells that had trees in them, we did not start recovering any TCE or metabolites until after leaf drop, which was in November. However, when we showed these slides originally to people, especially to the regulators who were working on the project with us, their comment was, well, yes, but if you look at the slopes of these bars, it looks like maybe you just delayed the amount of TCE that was coming out of the system, that you were pumping out of it, and that eventually the ones with trees are going to be yielding as much as the cell without trees. So, valid comment. So we start growing the trees for a second season. Slide 71 shows the trees. These trees on the left are our control trees, and the trees on the right are the ones that were being dosed with TCE. Slide 72 shows our data from the second growing season, and now you can see we have the first year and the second year, so we have our control cells, that have no trees. And what we found is that we were recovering roughly about 80% of the amount of TCE that we were putting into the system, between 80 and 90% as TCE and metabolites. But if you look at the dots at the bottom of the slide, you can see that where there were trees in the system, we were getting virtually no TCE out of the system, that it was being taken up by the trees and something was happening to it. But we weren't really sure what. So on slide 73, you can see some of the methods that we looked at to see whether or not the trees were transpiring it. Was the TCE just moving through the plant and being released into the atmosphere, either from the leaves or from the trunk of the trees? And what we found was that very, very little of it was. We could only account for about 8% of the total TCE taken up by the trees being volatilized in the second year. And in the third year we ran the system, we did not see any TCE being volatilized by the trees. Slide 74 gives you an idea of how fast some of these trees can grow. So on the left side you see the trees when they were planted, and this was May of 75. And on the right side you have the same trees, and this was in August 2 years later. And for a reference point, the person who's standing in the slide is my field technician, and he's 6'4". So you can get an idea of how fast these trees are growing. Okay, in slide 75, we have our third year of data. So this one is a little bit more complex. So we have our first year, and the additional lines that we have in there now are what we were putting into the system as well as what we were getting out of it. So you can see in the second year, what we were putting in was pretty much what we were getting out as far as TCE and metabolites. If you look in the third year, we can see how much was being added to the cells, and at the bottom of the chart, you see how much we were recovering in the cells with trees. We had even greater removal of the TCE from the system when the trees were there. So now the question is, what exactly is happening with these plants, and where is the TCE going, which was a really big problem for us. Because as you can imagine, a lot of the regulators were saying, well, this is very interesting, but you have to be able to tell us where the TCE is going to. So if you look on slide 76, and I'll walk you through this because it is kind of a complicated slide. There's a line at the bottom, and this is the background levels of chloride in the soils on the system. Now, remember we had a cell that had trees that was receiving the same amount of water as the treated trees, but no TCE was added. Now, one of the problems we had was that the water we were using was city water, and it was chlorinated. So if you look at the blue bars, you can see that as we increased in depth in the soil, we did have an increase in chloride ion in the soil. But if you look at the yellow bars in this slide, this is the amount of chloride ion that was recovered from the soil in the cells that had TCE and the poplar trees added to them. And as you can see, in the 8 to 16 inch depth, we have huge increases in the chloride ion concentration underneath these trees, within the heavy rooting zone of these trees. And when we calculated this out, we could account for over 70% of the TCE that was added to the systems as free chloride ions in the soils. If you look at slide number 77, what you see is one of the questions we were asked repeatedly was, well, can you be sure that this is due to tree uptake and not microbial degradation in the soil, which is a very real question here. We know that there are soil bacteria that are perfectly capable of degrading the TCE. Now, in this slide, what we're seeing here is we have to go back and remember that I said we were always maintaining 6 to 8 inches of water at the bottom of the aquifer, which is why the amount of water or TCE added fluctuated and it wasn't a flat line, because we were adding enough water to maintain that water balance at the bottom of the cells, and this was going to be predicated on how much the trees were taking up on any individual day. Well, at the end of the 97 growing season, what we decided to do, and this was about in September, so our trees are still fully leafed out, it's still warm out, we started adding in the same volume of TCE-containing water that we did in July and August. So we're adding in more TCE-containing water than the trees were taking up at this time of the year. And what you can see is that when this occurs, all of a sudden we start recovering TCE and metabolites back in the groundwater flow system. That the removal of the TCE from the system is directly tied to water uptake by the trees. Now, this is not to say that there is not microbial degradation occurring in the root zone of these trees. However, because they have such huge water uptake rates, the bulk of the removal is taking place due to tree uptake rather than microbial degradation in these systems. Okay, so if we move on to slide 78, just some of the other compounds that my laboratory and other groups have looked at over the years. So we have gasoline compounds like MTBE, benzene, and other gasoline additives that get into groundwater can be remediated with phytoremediation. Pesticides such as lindane, ethylene dibromide, explosive compounds like TNT, solvents, de-icing agents. So there's a wide range of compounds that can be taken up by the plants and degraded. Now, of course, we're having these wonderful ideas of, hey, look, we can get the trees to take up these compounds in our very controlled field system, but what happens when we move into the field? Some of the things that you're going to have to do if you want to move this technology into the field, and I should make a little aside here quick and say that most of these regulatory concerns that I'll be talking about are ones that regulators who are colleagues of mine have brought to my attention that we have discussed over the years. And if there are any regulators on the call and you have any additional comments or concerns, I would certainly be willing to add them into this presentation for future talks. Okay, one of the big problems with any new technology that's out there is that a lot of the regulators are going to be unfamiliar with the processes that are taking place, and a lot of the people who are putting in these systems don't necessarily understand the systems as well as they understand more engineered type of systems. They're working with people like myself or other plant people to install these. And this can be a problem if you're dealing with the regulator on your own, because the regulator is going to ask you a question, and if you have to stand there and say, oops, I don't know the answer to that, you're not going to get acceptance by the regulator. So having teams that work together are going to be really important. The other problem is that we don't know all the answers. As I said, this is still an emerging technology, and we're still working to try to understand everything that's happening within the plants. The other thing that's going to be a regulatory issue is testing and monitoring. Because this is a new technology, there are going to be questions about how often do you have to do monitoring on the sites? What type of things need to be tested? Well, obviously you're going to need to do soil and water, but you're going to have to do air samples because you're going to need to find out if the compound is being transpired. You're going to do plant tissues to look for the parent compound for metabolites, which are proof of degradation. And then the problem is, how do you analyze these samples? For a lot of these processes or a lot of these samples, we don't have standardized methods. So if you talk to five different laboratory or academic people who are working on this, you might come up with five different methods for extracting a particular metabolite from plant tissue. Nothing has been regulated, nothing has been standardized, so a lot of the standard analytical labs won't even touch these types of samples because they don't have these protocols in place. You're going to have some rather unusual monitoring parameters. One of the big ones is going to be tree health. If your trees are healthy and happy and growing, there's a good chance that they're sending their roots down to intercept the contaminated groundwater. If your trees are all dead, this is a very big problem. You're going to have water issues, which is not just are the trees reaching the groundwater, but how much water are you going to have to irrigate on the trees to get them established? Nutrient availability is going to be something that you're going to have to monitor, not for remediation, but to maintain tree health. You're going to have problems that have nothing to do with the contaminant you're trying to remediate that could be killing the plants. You're going to have a lot of other things that are interacting with the plants on the site that would not be a problem if you're putting in a traditional pump and treat system there. So fungal infections, bugs, deer, other munching critters that can get onto the site can have a very negative impact on your plants. Convincing regulators that plant health can be a viable measure for criteria of success. And this is something that we have done on a couple of our plants, of being able to say that the plants are of a certain size, they are healthy, doing excavations to show that the roots have reached the groundwater, which is the photo that you see of me down in the hole there, showing that the roots are reaching into the groundwater. You're going to have problems with weather impacts on monitoring. If you're trying to do transpiration studies and you're looking at how much compound and how much water is being taken up by a plant on a given day, you're going to have to go out there and do your monitoring on a day that's going to give you representative numbers. So if it's pouring down rain, you can't do any type of monitoring out there because the trees are not going to be taking up any water from the aquifer, and you're going to get virtually zero results. You're going to have no transpiration, no compound within the trees. So this is going to be something that you have to discuss with the regulators from the very beginning of the project. One of the sites that we were working on, we had to say, okay, it says in the work plan that sampling will be done the first week of a particular month, but we needed the variability or the flexibility that if we had adverse weather conditions, we could actually do the sampling and the monitoring on a week later or even 2 weeks later because of weather conditions. You're going to have different standards for success with a phytoremediation or basically any new type of technology that you're going to work with. So what are your standards going to be for success? Plant survival, of course, is a very big standard. Knowing that your roots are penetrating down into your groundwater is going to be a standard for success. Transpiration of the compound by the plants, presence of metabolites within the plant are all indications that the plants are taking up the compounds. In some cases, if you have a slow enough moving groundwater and you have a large enough planting area, you can actually see depression of the groundwater. You can do soil analyses as well as groundwater analyses to look for changes in the contamination levels in these two media. You're also going to have to deal with security issues, and I can tell you from absolute experience that securing a field can be a lot more challenging than securing a building. You can have problems, and we have had this on two of our sites, with squatters or vagrants moving onto the site because you've essentially taken a very barren, very bare field and converted it to a very pretty garden spot with lots of trees and shelter, and this can be a problem. Community members can move onto the site. We've had problems with children getting onto the site and basically destroying some of our monitoring systems. One of the things that we wound up doing is having to have a lot of community involvement to have them watching over the site to make sure that everything is okay. And then the last thing is problems with environmental radical groups. And you might think that having a natural technology such as phytoremediation going on to a site would be much more accepted by some of the environmental terrorist groups, but that's not always the case. We had one site where we had a group that tried to get on the site, and they actually did. This was one of our laboratory field sites, fortunately, and they cut down all of our trees to protest that we were torturing the trees by exposing them to contaminants, so they killed all of the trees for us. I'm still trying to figure that one out. Another question that you're going to have to deal with is, do contaminants enter the food chain? This can be a very big issue for those contaminants that don't break down very rapidly within the plant, that they're accumulated within the plant. What happens when you have insects that feed on the plant? What happens when some other animal further up the food chain, like birds, starts feeding on these insects? Can this be a problem? You can have animals that are munching on the plants as well. This is slide 87. I'm sorry, I keep talking and I'm not giving you the slide numbers. I'll try to remember to do that.
That's okay, Dr. Newman. I was just getting ready to break in and get you back on track with the slide numbers, but we're doing fine.
Okay. And as I said, you can have local people coming in, taking plants, removing monitoring equipment, moving monitoring equipment, or even field monitor or layout designs for you. On slide 88, you can see a lovely photo of some of the deer that got in through the deer fence, which was not as effective as we might have liked out there. And I can tell you that this was a site that we had had a major problem with the deer. And I am actually a vegetarian. And after spending 2 years chasing this herd of deer around the field, trying to get them back through the opening in the fence, venison steaks were starting to sound very, very appealing to me. We've also, as I said, had children that got onto the site and moved a lot of our monitoring equipment around. We had stakes that that marked where some of our trees were on the field site, and we had the neighborhood children came in and stole all our little stakes and were using them to play war games in their backyards. We did not appreciate the help that they gave us on this. On slide 90, we're going to go through a little bit of decision making, because as with any new technology, you have to be able to decide whether or not phytoremediation is going to be a worthwhile technology for you to put on your site. There's a lot of different technologies out there. How do you decide if phytoremediation is right? Well, start with a site evaluation. Even if you know that the chemical you're dealing with can be taken up and degraded by the plant, What about the site itself? You're going to have to look at the weather. Are you going to have a long enough growing season for these plants to be able to establish themselves? If you have a very dry climate, you may not be able to use poplars. I can tell you positively, poplars in Arizona do not mix very well. Water availability. For some of the plants, you're going to have water to start the plants to get them established before they'll start taking up groundwater. Soil fertility can be a very big problem. This is not a problem if you're putting in a mechanical pump and treat system. But if you don't have reasonably fertile soil or soil that you can fertilize, you're not going to get your plants to survive. And then, of course, toxicity is the problem. We have worked on sites where the groundwater contamination was within reach of the plants. It was within a concentration range that the plants could deal with. However, we had some major problems with other contaminants that weren't necessarily above regulatory limits, but were lethal to the plants in the soil that we were trying to establish the trees in. So again, we're going to move on. Will phytoremediation work with the contaminant that you have on the site? There are a lot of groups working with different types of chemicals, but as you can imagine, there are an awful lot of contaminants out there, and really no one is paying us a lot of money to systematically survey every contaminant out there to see whether or not the plants can take it up. Do you know how the plants and the contaminants are going to interact? Are they just going to transpire it? And is this acceptable for the state that you're working in? So if you're in California, where they have basically a zero emission policy for remediation applications, if the contaminant is just taken up and transpired by the trees, this is not going to be acceptable. If you happen to be in South Carolina, where I live, where they don't worry about these things all that much, it's not a problem. And finally, is the technology acceptable to the regulators that you're working with? Okay, so if we're going to go back to site evaluation, is the site now, or could it ever be, applicable to plant growth? And one of the things that I can say is that parking lots and blacktop are not good growth mediums for plants. You can have a lot of sunshade issues. If you have an area that is surrounded by tall buildings and doesn't get much sun, your plants aren't going to survive. And again, you can have soil toxicities that is not related to the contaminants. Now, this is a standard yes, no, or go, no-go type of decision tree that has been put together by the EPA, and if you go to the CLUIN website from that page in the beginning of the talk, you can download a whole bunch of these different types of go, no-go decision trees for different types of phytoremediation. So we're not going to go over this. Okay, so if you decide that phytoremediation is going to work and the regulators have bought in on this, next step is how do you design the site so that you can actually apply phytoremediation on your site. So on slide number 96, you can have some rather unique site preparation problems that you don't have to deal with if you're going with more traditional pump and treat types or barrier methods for groundwater remediation. And as I said, concrete is concrete is not dependent on soil nutrients, but your plants certainly will be. Soil compaction can be a very big issue, so you may not have blacktop, but if you have a parking lot that is clay that has been driven over by heavy trucks, this can be a problem, as well as the shade from other buildings or other plants. You can have security issues that you're going to have to deal with. You're going to have to make sure that you can fence off your field so that you don't have animals, children, vagrants moving onto your property. On 98, weather is going to be something that you're going to have to deal with in designing your remediation scheme. You're going to have to look at when and how you're going to do your transpiration measurements, when and how you're going to do your tissue testing on these sites. So if the regulator is insisting that you are going to do transpiration readings on your trees, you're going to have to design the site such that you can have electricity out in the field so that you can move equipment out there that you're going to need to do these types of testing. You're going to have to be working with Mother Nature, and this is something that is a problem for a lot of the engineers that I've worked with when they've started on these projects, is that if you're doing construction projects, you can go basically any time of the year. But when you're planting plants, you have to work in season with nature, and you can't plant your crops in January. You want to plant them in the springtime so that they have time to grow and develop and do a good job at what you're trying to get them to do. You're going to have to deal with all of the things that deal with nature. You're going to have to deal with the bugs and the birds and the other problems. One of the things we had on one of our sites is that when we used colored flags to mark where we put our trees, not only did we have problems with children stealing our flags, but we had crows that came onto the site, and they would see these pretty flags in the ground, and they would rip them up and haul them around for us. And this was a problem that we had to work out a way to keep the crows from stealing our equipment on the field. You're going to need to make sure that you have the right plants for your site. And there's two things here. One, you have to make sure that the plant you're working with will be able to take up and degrade or interact with the contaminant in a way that you and the regulator have set as a desirable endpoint. And you also have to make sure that that particular plant is going to survive on your site. You want to make sure that the plants are capable of growing in your climate with your weather conditions. So on slide 101, you can see that we've done a lot of work on this. We've done field trials with different types of poplar trees, which are the trees that are used primarily for remediating groundwater because of their fast growth and high water uptake rates. We've also done greenhouse studies, and this is on slide number 102, again looking at different types of poplars, but also other types of plants. So we've screened things like sycamore, sweet gum, willow, evergreen plants to try to have a better palette of plants or better list of plants that we can go out onto the different sites with. Slide 103. Okay, before you install, why feasibility testing is a good idea? Well, better to have the plants die in the greenhouse than try to explain to your to the site owner why there is 10 acres of brown out in the middle of a field. Slide 104, okay, when you're preparing the site for planting, again, and I can't emphasize this enough, and the reason I'm saying that is because heaven knows I've made these mistakes often enough, and there's no reason for you to repeat them, is that weather plays a very important role. You don't want to be out there plowing mud. You plow mud, and you're going to have things like your tractor getting stuck up to the axles and having to have a truck to pull you out, which is very humiliating. You're going to have huge soil compaction issues when you're plowing mud. You're going to have to think like a farmer. Prepare the fields the times that the farmers do and the way that the farmers do. And one of the things that we've found is for a lot of the sites we've worked on is if you can get local farmers to work with you, they can be an absolutely invaluable source of practical information. So this is a photo where I'm showing this. This is me standing in the middle of a field where we did lots and lots of plowing to mix in soil amendments. and we created one of the most spectacular hard pans underneath our field site that you could possibly imagine. And when we turned on our irrigation system, where we had worked in all of our soil amendments, we wound up with a gigantic puddle. And that actually got close to knee-deep in various areas, and that is me out there with an iron bar trying to poke holes in the hard pan to loosen it up so that we could get drainage. So again, working with the farmers on how to mix in the amendments and how to work the soil can be absolutely invaluable. Slide 106 is one of the sites that we worked on for the Department of Energy, and this was a coal ash basin. Now, this is not groundwater, but this is just pointing out what not to do on your sites. This was a coal reject coal ash basin, and there was a huge compaction issue. So they came up with the idea, well, we need to plow this to break up the compaction. But what happened was when they broke up the compaction, they brought more acidic materials up to the surface. And on slide 107, what you can see is an area where they broke up the compaction is on the left. And you can very barely make out in the very center of the slide the absolutely positively dead pine tree that's there because of the lowered pH that was created by the plowing. In an area where there was no plowing, which is the slide on the right, the trees actually survived. So you really need to know how your treatment's going to work and make sure that you're not making the site worse when you're trying to prepare it. One of the things that we have done when we've planned a lot of these sites, especially when there are things like very deep groundwater, is how can we combine the technologies or the phytoremediation with other technologies. One of the things that we have done on a number of our sites is to do something called pump and irrigate, where we have tapped into existing treatment systems that are doing, sending it perhaps to a carbon filtration system and taking the water during the summer and using it to irrigate the trees. And then in the winter time when the trees go dormant, it goes back into the other types of treatment system. There have been applications where they have had a containment wall and they've used planted trees behind the containment wall, and the trees manage the water and also help with the degradation of the contaminant. There have been combinations of reactive barriers in plants, combined bio and phytoremediation where the plants were being used to supply growth nutrients for bacteria that were involved in bioremediation, and using plants to minimize recharge zones so that you have less groundwater movement or less movement of the contaminant through the soil and thus into the groundwater. This is a photo of one of the systems where we did this at the Department of Energy site, where we had a deep aquifer that was over 80 feet deep, contaminated with trichloroethylene, and the problem was that there was an intervening clean aquifer that we needed to protect. So what we did is we pumped up the water to the surface, irrigated the trees with the contaminated water. We had numerous lysimeters, as you can see in the photo on the right on slide number 109, where we had lysimeters that showed, or where we were able to sample to make sure that we did not have any leakage of the contaminated water beyond the root zone of the plant and thus possibly contaminating that clean aquifer. And this is a way that we used a pump and irrigate system that got around the limitations of plant rooting depth. On slide 1010, the Department of Energy has done this on other sites with tritium. Here what they did was they put in a barrier wall that caused the tritium contaminated water to pond up, and then they sprayed this on the existing forest land around the system. So the trees were acting as a volatilization system for the tritiated water. So now I'm going to talk about a few of the sites that we've actually installed and talk about some of the things that worked and, more importantly, what not to do if you're planning on doing a phytoremediation system of your own. First site was the very first one that we actually installed. This was in Medford, Oregon. And as I said, timing of installation can be critical. We were doing the planting or site preparation in the late winter, early spring, which is absolutely the worst time to be plowing it. and we had a lot of problems. We put in the irrigation systems, or had the irrigation systems put in before we got all of the soil preparation done, which meant that we were constantly digging up irrigation lines there. We had huge mud problems on the site because we were trying to get this site prepared during the rainy season in that area of the country. And then on slide 113, you can see the type of soil, if you want to call it that, that we were actually planting in. This was an old parking lot that we were planting in, and it was more riprap than it was soil. So it was a bit of a challenge. You can see our little stick in the center there, surrounded by all of the rocks. On slide 114, this is the same plantation 2 years later at the end of the second growing season. As you can see that the trees did survive. Now, this was another site where we did a pump and irrigate system. This time it was an underground drip irrigation system because Oregon did not want release of the contaminants into the atmosphere. And what we found with these type of systems is that not only does it overcome rooting depth, but it also gives a better feel for how effective the plants are. So by having lysimeters in the system to be able to say that you do not have breakthrough of the contaminant beyond the root zone of the trees, you can also say how much has been taken up by the plant and how much contaminant you have treated. So on this particular plot, which is a little less than an acre, we were able to treat just shy of 1 million gallons per growing season. So we were able to tell the regulators exactly how much water we treated and how many pounds of contaminant we removed from the system by monitoring the concentration of the water that was going on to the plantation, or the concentration of the contaminant in the water going on to the plantation. On slide 115, we've done work on several Navy bases, and I'm going to talk about a couple of them here. This particular Navy base, we also had the problem where they decided they wanted an Earth Day planting. They wanted us to be able to go out there and have this installation on Earth Day. So we were basically plowing and moving mud and had a very unrealistic time schedule. We wound up having a problem with the equipment constantly sinking into the mud, and the contractors wound up putting down a wood chip road throughout the plantation so that the trucks wouldn't sink. But this had the problem of robbing the soil of nitrogen as soil bacteria started degrading our wood chips. We also had problems where our staging area also had a lovely area of compaction, and we wound up with basically a swimming pool out there. So slide 116 shows what we were dealing with as far as the plowing the mud. Slide 117, you can see some of the, again, the puddles that we were dealing with when we were trying to put in the monitoring wells out there. But on slide 118, you can see that on Earth Day, we were out there planting the trees. And again, this is when I mentioned at the beginning about community involvement and how the community really likes this technology. We had our little trees, which are our little hardwood cuttings that look essentially like a pencil that we're putting in the ground. And you can see on the bottom right, we had community people out there. We had the base commander out there. On the top photo, we had people from the state senator's office, from the U.S. congressional people. We had EPA representatives. We had the State Department of Ecology representatives out there. We had the base chaplain out there blessing the trees as we passed them one by one down the line and out into the field to be planted. Slide 119, I'm going to be going through these kind of fast because we're running out of time here. We did have the problem with very severe nitrogen deficiency because of our wood chip road. But the plants did survive, and by the third growing season, we had the trees out there looking like they are in slide number 120, and we were able to show that they were getting down, and the roots were getting down into the aquifer on the site. We're going to skip a little bit here. On slide 122, this is a site that we worked on out on the coast of Washington, and this, again, is an area where we wound up having a lot of construction at the wrong time of the year. They created compaction zones in the soil, and we basically created our own little lake out there. On slide 123, we did get plants growing, but as you can see, our weed control was not perhaps the best that one could imagine on that site. But on slide 124, we finally did get everything working on the site, even with the deer, these children stealing our markers and our plants. So on the left, you can see what the site looked like when we started, and on the right, what they look like by the end of the second growing season out there. Slide 125, this is a site that we did in Portland, Oregon. And on 126, if I was doing this in person, I actually have chunks of this material that I hauled out of the tree. And years later, what they did, again, they were plowing the field, which was had a lot of weeds in it during the late winter. And between the mud and the dried weeds, which were basically like straw, they did a phenomenal job of creating adobe out there. And this stuff was absolutely rock hard, and I could still build little houses with the stuff that I have sitting in my office. Slide 127, you can see what happened in areas where we had very poor growing conditions. So these photos were taken the same day. The person in there, it's the same person in both slides. So in areas where we did not have the horrible soil conditions, you can see what the plants look like. And then on the left, where we had horrible growing conditions, you can see that the trees were not surviving anywhere or growing anywhere near as well. Let's see, we're going to skip a little bit. We'll skip up to slide 130 so that we can finish close to being on time here. Now, here we had an interesting site, that this was a site that was contaminated with nitrates in the groundwater and nitrates in the soil, and it was so toxic, and the ammonia levels were so high in the soils that when we did laboratory testing, the students actually had to wear respirators in the greenhouses because of the ammonia vapors coming off the site or off of the soil. Now, in this instance, based on what we learned not to do in the field, or what we would normally say not to do in the field from our Navy base project, this is something that we actually did. We worked huge amounts of sawdust and pulp mill waste into the soils, and this was able to tie up a lot of the nitrogen to get the plants established out there. We also had problems. We'll skip ahead to slide 132. This is where you have the huge nitrogen problems there. And then slide 133, again, we were dealing primarily with contaminants in the groundwater, but what they didn't bother to tell us was that there was an old herbicide burn pit on the site. And they never bothered to mention this because the herbicides weren't above the regulatory limits for the soil. However, they still did a very effective job of killing our trees. Now, because we did do laboratory treatability studies before we went out there, we knew where all of the bad spots were on the site, and we were able to go out there with different types of soil amendments and different types of site preparations so that our plants would survive on the entire site and not look as dead as these when we planted them in the field. And slide number 34, you still have to be careful how you work those amendments in. Okay, the plants are finally growing, and what can go wrong at this point? Well, unfortunately, you can still have things that go wrong, and some of the things that can go wrong are mechanical breakdowns, the same as you would if you had an engineered system. If you're relying on irrigation water, if you're relying on water pumped from the contaminated aquifer, you have to make sure that those irrigation systems are working. You can have invaders of the four-legged kind getting out there and munching on your trees, and you want to make sure that you don't have problems like we did with people getting onto the site who were going to kill your trees to protest the fact that you're torturing them by growing them in contaminants. You need to make sure that you're monitoring the weather conditions out there, because if you are relying on the plants to reach groundwater on their own, but you have severe drought conditions, you may have to go out there and irrigate the plants to make sure that they don't die before they reach the groundwater. 136 shows the opposite of that, where we had very heavy rain conditions on one of our field sites and they started flooding, and we actually had to dig some drainage canals to get some of the water off the site so that it didn't kill the trees. Slide 137, again, deer and trees don't mix very well. The photo on the left shows what deer can do to a nice little tree that's just starting out there. slide number 138 is just some photos. It's been in the news lately about the environmental extremists that have been captured and brought to trial that were working in the Pacific Northwest. And this is just photos of some of their handiwork from when they bombed the University of Washington Center for Urban Horticulture to protest that people were doing genetic studies or genetic analysis on trees. So they're not something that you want to take lightly. You want to make sure that your site does have proper protection before you plant it and leave it alone. Okay, so you can still have some questions out there that you need to take care of. You need to make sure that the weather is monitored carefully because, again, you're dealing with a growing living system out there. So you want to make sure that your sample collection is done on days when you're going to get good, reliable samples that accurately represent what the trees are doing out there. You still need to make sure that you have a lab that is set up that is capable of analyzing the samples and is comfortable using the type of methods that you're going to be working with for those sample analyses. Slide number 38 or 140. Hey, question comes up again. Why do you want to put yourself through all of this? I mean, I'm talking about an awful lot of problems that you might run into on these sites. Well, it can be a lot less expensive. The Navy base where we installed the phytoremediation system had looked at alternatives. Two that they had looked at were excavation and incineration, and also putting in barrier walls and a pump and treat system. And both of those technologies priced out at around $10.5 million. The phytoremediation system that we put in, which involved a huge amount of engineering because the site was originally blacktop, we had to pull that up, reroute storm drains, and do huge amounts of monitoring to meet the regulator's criteria, still came in at less than $3.5 million. So it was almost over a 60% savings for the Navy. Citizens groups like the trees. They really like the idea, and in a lot of the sites that we worked on, phytoremediation as the remedy of choice was very strongly influenced by community groups. For a lot of the regulatory agencies that I have worked with, they are looking favorably at groups that will try innovative technologies. And from my perspective, and for those of you who have an academic bend, I find it an absolutely fascinating technology because you are learning every step as you go. My background is in plant science and genetics, and I spend my time dealing with engineers and regulators and hydrologists, and it's just a constant learning system learning opportunity when you're out there doing it again. So the only thing I can say is have faith in the trees. They really do work. For those of you who are interested in data on some of these sites, I do have photos or copies of papers that I can send you that have the data on there. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Newman. That was a very nice presentation.
And I absolutely flew through it so that we would get done on time.
You did. You did very, very well. We knew you had a lot of slides to get through. I would just like to close very briefly here. I'm going to take care of this in about 30 seconds, and then we're going to move to question and answers, and we will stay with those as long as we have participants. I'd like to thank you, Dr. Lee Newman, and also Dr. Jim Field. I'd also like to thank Larry Reed and Steve Manjan for assisting with the introductions today. And I'd like to invite you to stay tuned to the Clue-In calendar as well as the Superfund Basic Research Program mailing lists for announcements of additional upcoming events, both on the DINAPLES issues as well as other issues in the future. I would like to mention that we are planning to reschedule two additional repeat sessions for the DINAPLES series. We'll be repeating the first session, which was Source Zone Behavior and Mass Flux Measurement, and we're also going to be repeating Dr. Cass Miller's presentation on Enhanced Techniques for Subsurface Remediation. With that, I'd like to go ahead and thank CLUIN.org as well as EPA's Technology Innovation Program and the NIEHS Superfund Basic Research Program for sponsoring today's seminar. With that, we'll go ahead and go to question and answers, and we'll just end there. I've done my closing spiel. So if you're on the phone and you have a question and you've managed to stay with us this long, we appreciate it very much. Go ahead, take your phone off mute and introduce yourself, name your organization, and ask your question.
Hi, Lee. This is Steve Manjin. I thought I'd take the liberty of jumping in first. One of your early slides showed phytoremediation applications being for, one was something called green roofs, and the other was called landfill caps. And I wasn't quite sure what those two referred to. I can imagine that the cap may have had something to do with treating methane as it's off-gassing from a landfill. At least there's been some speculation in the room about that. But I was wondering if you could say a little bit more or maybe provide references at a later time to me or to Larry Reed for distribution.
Yes, I certainly can. The landfill caps, there's a lot of work being done, and there's actually an EPA RTDF group that is, an IPRC group that is dealing with the landfill cap remediation, and this deals not only with the methane issues but also dealing with leachate coming off of the landfill, as well as minimizing movement of groundwater or movement of rainwater into the landfill systems. And they've been doing an absolutely fantastic job educating people about this, and I can certainly send you the contact information about that. As far as the green roofs, what they're looking at is using plants to control the amount of water that is running off of roofs, and this is particularly important in city areas where you don't have a really good system for dealing with the water that is coming off these roofs other than sending it into the sewage system. So by planting the roofs with different types of vegetation, the plants take up the water, they minimize the amount of water that's coming off the roof, especially in cities where you might have tarred roofs, you're going to have various type of hydrocarbons coming off the roof. This is totally eliminated, and it's an area that's getting a lot of information or a lot of interest. The city of Chicago is doing a huge number of city buildings with green roofs, so it's really kind of an interesting area.
Thank you.
Okay, let's take a question from one of our Internet participants. This is from Steve McCollum of Glenfos in Chatsworth, California. He asks, when tested, does the tree litter or wood represent a hazardous waste?
Okay, the tree litter we have tested, we have had two groups tested, because there are metabolites that are still in the leaves when they fall off the trees. And we've had two groups do it. One has finished the study, and this was at Clemson University, and another group that's still working on it, looking at what happens when insects feed on this material. And virtually, we're not seeing anything. We have not seen any toxicity with any of the insects that have fed on the leaf material after it drops in the fall. As far as the wood, it depends on what you're planning on doing with it. We have taken wood chips or trees that we have cut down or thinned out or branches that have fallen. We've chipped up the branches and just let them sit out and air out and then use them for walkway material. So we test them to make sure there are no contaminants in the trees and put them down there. We have also taken some of the trees and shipped them off to a pilot scale plant where they made paper out of the trees, because a lot of the poplar trees are grown for paper. And if you're familiar at all with the craft process for producing paper, as you can imagine, if the process is stringent enough that it can break down lignin and cellulose, a little TCE molecule doesn't stand a chance in this type of system. But we've done this, we've made the paper, we've tested the paper, and there are no contaminants in the paper.
Okay, I've got another question from an Internet participant. This is from your neck of the woods, Dr. Newman. This is Adam McConnell with the Gel Group in Charleston, South Carolina.
Okay.
He asks, are there any trees which are suitable for swamp or wetland environments such as cypress?
Well, most of the plants that we tend to grow are ones that we know we can propagate very rapidly and have very rapid growth. So we haven't really looked at cypress. However, we're currently doing a test with Arundo, which is a grass that grows in marshland conditions, looking at its ability to take up TCE and penta. Some of the other plants that we've worked with, we have done cypress, but that was more for controlling metal runoff off of the site. We haven't used any marsh trees to look at phytoremediation. I'm trying to think. We've also done a study with switch cane, which is a grass that is used in a lot of streamside restoration projects because it likes the streamside systems, it likes growing with its feet wet, and we've seen that this is capable of taking up both TCE and PCE, and we have seen metabolites of TCE in that plant system. So trees, no, but we have looked at other grass-type species, and we're continuing to do that for marshland applications.
I think you may have answered the second part of his question there, which I was just getting ready to add. This is also from Adam. He asks, are there applications for PCE?
Yes, we have done, we have personally done TCE, PCE, carbon TED, MTBE, ethylene dibromide, 1,2-dibromoethane, you know, a whole suite of them. And truthfully, every one of the chlorinated ethenes, propenes that we have looked at, the trees have taken up and have been able to metabolize at one level or another.
Great. Let me remind the audience that we also have Dr. Jim Field still with us. So let's open up for questions to both the presenters. We've only got just a couple of more minutes, and I realize that much of the audience may have already left. But let's open it up or check with the phone lines. Any remaining questions for either of today's presenters? If you would, take your phone off mute and introduce yourself, name your organization, and ask your question.
Hi, this is Jim Field. A question for Lee. In one part of your presentation, you showed how the inorganic chloride levels in the soil increased, and that was to demonstrate that the TCE was becoming metabolized.
Yes.
And then a couple slides further up, then you pointed out how the overwhelming majority of the water is taken up by the trees.
Mm-hmm.
So does that mean that the TCE is being metabolized in the trees? So I guess my question is if the inorganic chloride is being produced in the leaves, how does that explain that the inorganic chloride level in the soil is increasing?
What we think is that the inorganic chloride was being produced in the root system, and the excess chloride was being pumped back out of the roots. Tree roots have a very good system for being able to take up excess chloride and then release it back into the soil or water. And one of the things that we've done to show this is you can grow a little poplar cutting hydroponically, and then take it out of the system that it's growing in and put it in chloride-free water, and you will have a huge increase in chloride levels in the water because the plant is pumping excess chloride. A lot of trees do what is called luxuriant uptake of chloride, that they take up much, much more than they can use, and then they pump it back out. So it's a constant flux of being taken up and pumped out by the plant. And what we think is happening is that the TCE is being taken up, and that when the chloride is removed from the TCE and the ethylene is just going into a normal carbon pathway in the plant, that excess chloride or the chloride from the TCE moves into the same pathways that would get rid of or flush out excess chloride in the plant. Now, I'll be the first one to admit that this is all hypothesis, that we are still working on the systems to try to prove what's really happening here. And in any system, there is going to be, you're going to have abiotic degradation just from that's happening in the soil, you're going to have bacterial degradation, you're going to have plant degradation, you're going to have plant transformation, and it all kind of works together in the system, and we're just trying to make hypotheses of what we think is happening based on the data we have and then designed experiments so that we can test this and see if we're even close to being right in our hypotheses.
Thank you. I'm going to ask Larry Reed for a couple of final questions, and then we'll end for today. Larry?
Thanks, Larry. Lee, just a follow-up complimentary question to the question about swamps and wetlands.
Mm-hmm.
What about the limitations for their northern climate, say in the Great Lakes area, given the seasonal differences there? What considerations do you have for the applicability and the seasonal concerns in, you know, Ohio, New York, Steve Mangin's neck of the woods, that part of the area, part of the country?
It is very definitely a concern. Obviously, the trees are only going to be, or any plant is only going to be functional during the growing season. That it's not going to be taking up any water, whether it's surface water, groundwater, runoff water, if it's not actively growing and metabolizing. So there are going to be sites that you could grow trees, but it's not going to be appropriate to put phytoremediation because you have too short a growing season. The groundwater is moving just way too fast for it to be able to be controlled. We have looked at sites where there was very slow movement of the groundwater, that the groundwater moved only a couple feet a year. And in that instance, we could plant enough trees such that even when the trees shut down, the contaminated water didn't move beyond the boundaries of the plantation before the trees leafed out and started growing again. One of the other things that some groups have looked at doing is having phytoremediation as part of a treatment train. So you would have phytoremediation, which would handle the contaminant during the growing season, and then carbon filtration or some other type of more expensive treatment that handled it during the off season. And that reduced your cost because you're not going with a more expensive technology year round, and but it's protecting the groundwater when the trees are not functional.
Thank you. That answered that question. Thanks very much.
Let me just remind, if there's anyone remaining on the lines waiting for an answer to your questions, those of you who submitted questions on the Internet, I will be forwarding all of those questions to the presenters today, and we'll get you answers by email. If you're still on the phone and still waiting to ask a question, the contacts for me as well as both of today's speakers are listed on the seminar webpage, and please feel free to send us additional questions by email. With that, just a final thanks to today's presenters, Dr. Lee Newman, University of South Carolina, Dr. Jim Field, University of Arizona, also my colleague Larry Reed and Steve Mangin from EPA Region 1. Thanks to everyone, and please stay tuned for additional sessions in the Risky Learning Seminar Series. Very much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.